So it's a pleasure to welcome you this evening. I hope you're refreshed and relaxed after a short break. To this final session of the day, our keynote speaker, Professor Alison McGrath. He's going to speak to us under the title of New Frontiers in Science and Faith, and that is the title for the whole of this conference over 3 days. It's a particular pleasure to introduce him. I'm sure he needs no introduction at all, but that's not going to stop me from giving one. Alistair's first degree was in chemistry in Oxford, a subject close to my own heart, where he then went on to do a PhD in medical biophysics, getting his, DPhil, this is Oxford. He gained his DPhil, and during the final years of doing that, also studied for a degree in theology, I think obtaining a first class degree in theology only 1 year after obtaining a PhD in molecular biophysics, which is no mean achievement. Since then, he's been abroad in Vancouver at some stage. He's been principal of Wycliffe Hall. He's ordained, served in the parish for a while, and is a professor in Oxford University. So we look forward to a very stimulating evening this evening. Many of you are now his recent work refuting Richard Dawkins in a couple of books that he's I find him now in the secular bookshops alongside Dawkins' books of equal importance. So we're looking forward to a very stimulating evening this evening. What we will do is Alison will talk for us for as long as he takes, and then we will take a considerable time for questions, and there will be roaming mics around to take those questions. And we will draw some sometime after 9 o'clock. We'll see how it goes. And obviously, we'll be around afterwards if you have any questions. So, a particular pleasure to introduce Alison to this evening and ask him to deliver our keynote speech.
That show us that this field is intrinsically interesting, it's moving, and that's why I think the scientists of those represented here this evening actually have very significant contributions to make. I'm going to look very briefly at 6 areas. One is the growing, or should say continuing, interest in anthropic phenomena. Been around for a while now, but still being talked about. What do they say? What do they take? Then perhaps most interesting of all, in very recent years, 2006 and onwards, we've seen the emergence of this very aggressive, widely rightly described as scientific atheism. I want to ask, why has it emerged? Why is it so important, of course? What might we begin to say in response? Then, a relative newcomer on the block, the cognitive science of religion, emerging in an extremely significant area for further discussion. I want to just highlight some of the things that are beginning to emerge and let you reflect on where these might take us. Then, one role sciences can play is stimulating theological discussion, and so as a theologian, this thing for me to ask, in what way can the intellectual rigor of the natural sciences help theologians try and develop something along the same lines themselves? There's a growing interest in the whole area of natural theology, not just because in 2005 we celebrated the 200th anniversary of the death of William Henry. And again, what is the importance of this area? Where might it take us? And finally, how on earth are we going to get more people interested in the relationship of the natural sciences and faith? That's the broad canvas I'm going to be speaking to this evening. And I begin by just focusing in on this very interesting area of anthropic phenomena. The whole idea has been around for some time. In fact, historians will tell you that this sort of way of thinking goes back way, way back to the Greeks. But certainly in recent times, we're looking at the 1970s, Brandon Carter, using the term trying to cross the idea that there seems to be something about the fundamental concept of nature that seems to suggest that if they were very slightly different, we wouldn't be here to be talking about these things at all. Obviously, the word anthropic has come in for a lot of criticism. It comes from the Greek word anthropos, meaning a person. And clearly, Carter himself does not really say the universe is designed to bring about us, but maybe it's designed to bring about life. And so maybe biocentric rather than anthropocentric or anthropic might be a better way of speaking. And of course, that goes back to much earlier discussions of this. For example, you might think of Lawrence Henderson at Harvard, and in 1913, this remarkable book, The Thickness of the Environment. And again, a quote that many of you will know very well from this book. The whole evolutionary process, he wrote, both cosmic and organic, is one. And the biologist may now rightly regard the universe in its very essence as biocentric. Now again, a very controversial statement that many would want to distance themselves from. But again, an increasingly interesting statement, one that, if it is profitable to follow through, clearly has a lot to say. But we need to bear in mind that biocentric has not yet won the day. I mean, John Wheeler's views on this, I know, will be challenged by many, but it's worth remembering that back in 1974, John Wheeler argued that the universe doesn't properly exist until consciousness has arisen, and that the universe is described by a quantum mechanical wave function, which has to be collapsed in order for the universe to be, and therefore, this is the way his argument is going, there's the article, that in effect the term anthropic is appropriate, as indicates the importance of a participatory, conscious observer, not simply some sort of visionary mind. Now again, we have been very happy to teach John Ehrman's views, who I think would be very representative of just one way of reading the Copenhagen approach, but certainly again raising some intriguing questions for discussion. What I want to do this evening is just begin to broaden this discussion out. I think the whole discussion of the anthropic principle at the cosmological level has been well examined, including by some people tonight. What I want to do is try and look at two things that move us further. Number one, realizing that maybe these phenomena are much wider than simply cosmology. Number two, dealing with that most difficult question of all, so what? In other words, if there is anything here, where does it take us in terms of our reflections? And the key points I want to make is that similar phenomena are increasingly being observed in chemistry, biochemistry, and evolutionary biology. And it might be good just to look at some of these very briefly. Again, just revisiting my own history. For example, the organic chemistry of carbon. Were it very slightly different, carbon-based life wouldn't be happening. And again, people very often say, well, of course, silicon, which is very, very similar to carbon. I'm sure it is. But we do not see the propensity to find carbon to produce things like DNA, without which, of course, there is no evolution. So there's some very significant things there. Again, the physical chemistry of water. I mean, so much has been written about this. But again, you might want to think about it. Not simply talking about water, in effect, being such that when it freezes, ice goes to the surface, allowing life to continue under the surface, but much more complex in its solvation properties, its impact on protein folding. In other words, the remarkable properties of water, particularly at the physical level, being so important for the emergence of life, were it different, would we appear? And again, you will hear much talk about alternative solvents, for example, liquid ammonia, but again, there is something about water that merits a deep discussion in its own right. Or again, just to give you one more very simple example, the solvated properties of transition metal ions. Molybdenum, for example, plays a critical role in a number of biological systems. And it does so because it's just exactly too much for it. His point really, what if there was something different? And again, many of you will know that these kind of examples have been in America explored exhaustively in recent publications by Bob Williams in Oxford. And I mention Bob here partly because I think he writes extremely well, partly because he's written some extremely important works, but also he was the man who interviewed me before admission to Oxford and made the monumental misjudgment of lecturing. Despite the fact that when he grilled me on the Jan Kerouac effect, I regret to say, I clearly didn't have the muster. Bob and I have kept in touch, and there was a very thin party of Oxford recently celebrating his 80th birthday, and we were talking about precisely these things. And I said to him, Bob, doesn't this let all stuff make you wonder? And he knew exactly what I meant. He said to me, Alistair, I am not a religious man. But, and this is about to come, there is something very odd going on there. I think that's a very neat summary of the entropic principle. There is something very odd going on there. Or again, we might assume the evolution of biology. And again, there are some people tonight who will talk about this. Tomorrow will be a very important day. But again, as Simon Conway Morrison and Virtue's evolution. Again, you know, what is the role of contingency? Can one filter out contingency? Is there some sort of search engine which can only identify a limited number of possibilities? You see immediately, well, that line of thought thinking takes you, and indeed in Simon's book, My Solution, you'll find some of these ideas developed with some very, cautious reflection on where this might take us in reflecting on the nature of life and broader questions that still we're thinking about this evening. Well, again, Dennis Alexander recently, again, just begun to point out how, although one has to be very, very cautious about how one speaks about this, one can quite legitimately begin to talk about the apparent emergence of design within the evolutionary process. Now, again, we must be careful not to be simplistic, but there is something here that needs to look at. Well, again, Arduy and many others are highlighting the importance of evolvability. Again, those in the field will know this is a very broad subject. Let me just focus, if I may, on one specific question. If the universe were not the way it is, we would not be able to come to a point where biological evolution can actually take place. In other words, we're talking about the emergence of means of transmitting information, DNA, and the like. And if a number of chemical fragments is slightly different, that would not be true. So again, it's an intriguing area to follow through. But the real question is, what do they mean? And then I want to focus on this a little bit, because we just need to reflect on various possibilities. And what we need to, I think, be very honest about is that this may simply be a truism. That the fact that we are observing this makes us think it's very significant. But if we want to observe, well, it wouldn't be significant at all. And Erwin McMullen, again, as many will know, talking about the strong anthropic principle, in other words, there's some sort of design here, the world wants us to come and be, says that's indefensible. The weak anthropic principle, which is basically the idea that this in some way is indicative of something, he argues is true. Now that point is never going to go away. But there are alternatives that we can look at as well. One of them, of course, is Bernard Carr and others, get some essays on the idea of the multiverse. The basic argument here is, well, of course, this might be true for this particular universe which we inhabit and we study and we understand, but there might be a whole ensemble of these universes, each with their own distinctive identities, properties, and so on. This may be true of ours, but it might not be true of others. Again, there may be something in this, but there are other ways of looking at it. Well, again, Nick Bostrom, in many ways, Bostrom based on Oxford, developing this first point, that it is simply an observation selection effect. In other words, our location as observers means we see certain things. If our location were different, we would see something else. Therefore, we're affecting simply on what we know. And I can see all of these will need careful examination. But I do want to emphasize that it is a fourth option. That is to simply say this is entirely consistent with traditional revelation. And it does not need to be forced to be so. It simply resonates because of the way it is. And again, I thought I want to mention here, we do need to be very careful about the language that we use. This does not prove anything, but it is immensely suggestive. There's a resonance between what we as Christians would expect and what we actually see. I want to suggest to you that is a very significant point, but one that can be developed in some very interesting and important ways. If you just take me this further, the whole idea of empirical truth. When a faith would say, look, here is my world, here is the way I see reality, how does that match up with what I actually see in the world around me? And again, it's a very simple question. What worldview, what we're thinking, makes most sense of what we observe in the world? Or, put another way, what big picture offers the best account of what we experience? Now, obviously, I'm moving away from any rather reductive question. I'm saying, really, the question is, what big picture makes most sense of what we do observe, we do understand? I'm not looking for things we don't understand and trying to make God there. I'm saying the fact that we can make sense of things at all is actually quite remarkable. Explicability itself requires explanation. And of course, that immediately points to the idea of the world created by God, us as created by God in the image of God, with some sort of participation in God's rationality. Hence, there is a resonance or a congruence in the way we think and the way the world is. But this empirical fit, of course, can go a number of ways. This is Richard Dawkins' book, River Art Eden. Many will recognize this quote. I want you just to look at its structure. The universe we observe, he writes, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind bliss indifference. In other words, we observe, and then we ask, how does this fit? And don't you, this fits very, very well with this rather austere, I think I have to say, way of looking at things. But of course, there are alternatives. And you expect to quote C.S. Lewis, I'll do it once this evening. Here it is. It's on his best quotes. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. One more motto for this conference is basically saying, look, belief in God, belief in Christianity is interesting in itself, but it makes possible a new way of seeing everything else. It gives you an explanatory lens which allows you to make sense of things. It lets you see things at a different level. And Lewis, I think, is putting his finger there on something extremely important. And again, we might just pause and talk about this whole idea of inference to the best explanation. An idea that we need to value, because it's reminding us when we look at complex systems, there will always be competing explanations. And the question as to which is best is therefore going to be intrinsically important. And Gilbert Harman, back in 1965, introduced this actually slightly puzzling term, the inference to the best explanation. Puzzling, because you could perhaps infer that something is the best explanation. We're inferring to the best explanation, and it doesn't actually make that much sense, but the term is with us, and we're stuck with it. And Peter Lipton's second edition of this book is a classic. I want to follow this through. This is a very good book to read. Lipton, based at Cambridge. Again, the key issues are very, very simple. There are many explanations of the world. The question, therefore, is which offers the best fit? The simplest, the most elegant. And it reminds us a very important thing, I think, that in evaluating the world view, there are no knockdown arguments. It's an important point to bear in mind. For example, in interacting with the children or someone like that. But nevertheless, it is saying to us that we have every right to suggest A, that Christianity offers an explanation, and B, is an explanation that can stand up against the best of the alternatives. I want to stress again, this is not the goal of the gaps. And again, in Charles Coulson, who talked about this conference already, and he taught me here at the chemistry here at Oxford, let us lay preacher, that I think is a definitive statement on the problem of the goal of the gaps. Gaps of this sort, he writes, have the unpreventable habit of shrinking. And again, I want to caution us all against the kind of Christian apologetic that said, well, science can explain this. So there has to be a God. I'm grossly simplifying, but there is a danger there. And the danger is that in 5 years' time, that has gone because it's been explained. And I don't want you to do that, because you make difficulty for those who come after you, you have to deal with the offense of scientific explanation. Which brings us very quickly to this, the rise of scientific atheism. Four interesting books have been published in recent years. Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith, which I don't think is very good. Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. Dennis Breaking the Spell. Christopher Hitchens' God is not great, and you can have many, many more of these. But the key point is that number 2 and 3 on this, at least on the placement, base at least substantial parts of their case on the natural sciences. So we have the rise of this scientific atheism. What does this suggest we ought to be doing in response? Let's just begin by looking at some core arguments. In Dawkins in particular, we find this very outdated model of the relation of science and religion. Science and religion are at war. Only one can win, and it has to be science. Now again, it's unsustainable. There's a very influential, unsustainable argument. And you'll find many people just being sure that they're thinking this is right. More importantly, then, both of these writers share the view that Darwin is a worldview that illuminates transcendence, to use that modernist, very famous vocabulary from Darwin's Dangerous Idea, cranes and not skies. In other words, natural processes, not transcendent agencies. I think there are three issues arising from this that we'll look at this evening. First of all, this very simplistic assertion, science proves as religion asserts. Secondly, that there are no limits to the scientific method. And thirdly, that God is explained by this curious thing called the mean. It's a core argument in both Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, but more interestingly so in Gannett's Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell. So we'll just look at these 3 points, and I think they're all very attention. Does science have limits? And again, we'll all talk about this as models and answers. But it's a very important one, because the question being asked is, does science leave or create conceptual space for God? Now, clearly, Dawkins will argue that science proves things with certainty, and that we will argue that anything that is worth knowing can be proved by science, and everything else is just delusion or wishful thinking. And again, that is an influential perspective. I believe it to be wrong, but it is nevertheless extremely influential. And these organizations represented here have a very significant role in engaging with this perspective. Bertrand Russell, as you may know, adopted this position back in the 1920s. Whatever knowledge is attainable, he writes, must be attained by scientific methods. And what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. Very bold statement. Against that, we might look at a more recent perspective. There's Peter Medinger, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine was working in New Orleans back in 1960. There's a quote from a book called The Limits of Science, published in 1987. And his argument basically is that science is great. In fact, science probably has no limits when it comes to clarifying the interconnections of relationships within the material world. But when it comes to questions of meaning or value, science has limits. And again, you can see this in what he says. The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike, elementary questions like, what are we all here for? What is the And so what I want to ask you is, do you think Meadowell is right? I personally do, even though Meadowell was a self-confessed rationalist who had no place for religion, but he felt it was important to acknowledge that there were limits to the scientific method. And again, you might think of the psychologist Roy Baumeister's Meanings of Life, published in 1993, where he argued that the core things that give significance and vocation and direction to life include purpose, value, do I matter, efficacy, can I make a difference? Well, what I want to make is these are real questions, but I don't think they're questions that the natural sciences can answer. But they are nonetheless real questions. And so one thing I'd like to say in response to Walker is simply, I believe there are real questions that are rightly asked, and science cannot answer them. But that does not mean that there are no answers to be given. A very important question here is this. If the sciences are inferential in a methodology, how can Walker and others present atheism as a certain outcome of a scientific project? Now you can see this is a very important question, because clearly Dawkins would argue science shows that there is no God and that's it. But the idea that science might suggest this at this moment in time, but the consensus of scientific community might change in the future, is a very, very difficult one for them to accept. And again, you might think of someone like Richard Feynman, who has a very different perspective. Scientific knowledge, he wrote, is a body of statements of varying degrees of certainty. Some most unsure, some nearly sure, but none absolutely certain. And again, Polanyi's focus on knowledge is extremely important. He makes the point simply that scientists presently believe certain things to be true for very good reasons. But they also know that some of those things may turn out not to be right, to require revision. That's what radical theory change in science is all about. And so there are a number of questions we might ask. And one of these would be this. Is Darwinism one of these? It's a very uncomfortable question. Because certainly in Ellis' book and in Dawkins' book, you do get the impression that Darwinism is here to stay, and that settles the issue. But interestingly, elsewhere, Dawkins is much more cautious. This is from Devil's Chapter, published in 2003. We must acknowledge the possibility that new facts may come to light, which will force our successors of the 21st century to abandon Darwinism or modify beyond recognition. I think that's right. I think that possibility has to be borne in mind. But therefore, any worldview that is based on Darwinism as a scientific philosophy is intellectually vulnerable. And I think the most interesting question before us tonight is simply this. How can anyone take the contemporary consensus of a scientific community and make that the basis for a worldview, whether it is atheistic or theistic? It's a very interesting question. And what I think Dawkins doesn't really deal with the depth of needs. Again, there's a quote there of the written article, and this point is followed through in some detail.
And I'll give you an email address for this presentation afterwards if you'd like that. In both the Gong conclusion by Dawkins and Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, the idea of the me plays a critically important role. And in both these books, the me is presented, in effect, as standard scientific orthodoxy. I can suggest to you that this is simply not the case. And it was an extremely important point to be made here, that the meme is something which Dawkins may have a slight vested interest in, and when he invented the idea back in 1976, and we're now 30 years later down the line, and there still is not a sustainable scientific research program based on this idea. And Dawkins, as you will know, argues there is a very effective God meme, which makes people believe in God. And of course, this explains, or rather explains away, why so many people believe in God. And then develops a very similar idea in his book, Breaking the Spell. I thought to make 3 points in response to that. Number one, we seem to have a radical case of scientific underdetermination here. What actually is the experimental evidence for me? When there are so many, in my view, more interesting ways of explaining what may be observed. Second, Dawkins' definition of the meme is so deficient, I think, that in effect it means any worldview is caused by a meme. Therefore, is atheism caused by a meme? Or indeed, as some suggested, since there is so little experimental evidence for these things, is belief in memes itself created by But most intriguingly of all, if you read The God Delusion and Breaking the Spell very closely, there is a major difference. For Dennett, atheism is an example of a belief that arises from a meme. He does not see that as problematic. For Dawkins, atheism is just right. Belief in God arises from a meme. Now here's my question. How could these two gentlemen settle their differences empirically? I leave that one with you. I think Simon Colley Morris gets it right in his book Life Solution, where he said memes are trivial, be banished by simple mental exercise, they're hopelessly, if not in their simplicity. I find them very, very unacceptable, and it's not because they're used in an anti-religious context. It's simply that the idea, it seems to me, lacks experimental warrant. Let's move on. In recent years, the cognitive science of religion has begun to emerge as something extremely interesting. Pascal Boyer began in the 1990s, but more recently. We've seen people like Justin Barrett, Harvey Whitehouse, and Bob McCauley beginning to look very closely and empirically at how religious beliefs arise. And of course, Justin Barrett's book is a classic in this field, well worth reading. If you read Dawkins and Dennett, then you gain the impression this leads very quickly to atheism. It does not. It leads to some very interesting questions. And so we look at Bob McCauley's article, The Naturalness of Religion and the Unnaturalness of Science. And again, what he's doing is he's looking at the cognitive processes and asking how natural are these. This is what he finds. He draws the distinction between beliefs that are natural, by which he means minimally counterintuitive beliefs. Belief in God, belief in spirits, belief in forces. And his argument is that these are very easy to believe in. And again, he has empirical warrants for that. On the other hand, there are some things that are profoundly counterintuitive, that are not natural at all, that require you to stop and in many ways invert your mental frames of reference. And for him, the natural sciences and most Christian theology belong in this category. That's a very interesting observation for a number of reasons. On this analysis, religion is natural, but theology is unnatural. Now again, you might have to think about that. Because if you're in the business of Christian apologetics, you know, very often you defend Christian theological doctrines. But actually, if McCauley's right, you should be thinking about hot cognitions, you know, natural themes like there is someone who cares for me, and then building on that to some very interesting ideas here, which I think are intriguing. And actually, if McCauley is right, science and religion represents a cognitive mismatch. In other words, these are not comparing apples with apples. They are very, very different ideas. So some intriguing ideas that begin to come out of this. And McCauley's argument is that religious belief is simply unnatural. It's very, very easy to believe in God and so on. Whereas natural sciences are actually quite counterintuitive. And therefore, and again, Lewis Wolpert's book on natural science gets a very simple, similar point. And therefore, while religion will persist naturally, science needs constant cultural reinforcement if it's going to survive. It's not natural. It's something that you acquire and you have to keep on reacquiring and passing on. And again, an intriguing point. Dawkins argues in the God delusion that atheism is natural. It's all these fools who believe in God that force these unnatural beliefs on people. Well, it suggests the evidence actually is taken as a very different direction and one that might be extremely interesting. It's also bad news for like me and think systematic theology is interesting. It may be interesting, but it's profoundly counterintuitive. If I can just use Macaulay's frame of reference, it is one thing to say, again, very, very simply, Jesus loves me. It is quite another thing to say that when I think through what the implications of that might be, I come to the idea that Calcedonian definition of Christ as true God and truly human, consubstantial with Father, and so on. And the point is that you can draw that out from the first statement, but it makes serious intellectual demands, and it seems profoundly difficult and even conflictual. But so do so many ideas in science. And again, you might like to think of Bas Fasan's very famous quote, talking about the counterintuitive nature of so many scientific perceptions. And again, it's simply saying, look, there are some things that are very natural, there are some things that are counterintuitive. That doesn't mean they're wrong. It does mean a lot of intellectual labor to get from one to the other. If we're doing apologetics, the question of words is therefore very, very interesting. Science has, I think, an extremely good academic record. I personally say, in terms of all the human disciplines, science has, I think, established itself in terms of its past successes and its future possibilities as the most intellectually robust of human intellectual disciplines. And therefore, it's natural for theologians, who I think often feel a bit jealous of this, to ask, is there any way in which we might lean upon the success and use it to do theology in a better and more honest way? And as we're in Edinburgh, I thought it might be good just to recognize the importance of Tom Torrens. For many years, Professor of Christian Dogmatics here at Edinburgh, who actually from about 1959 onwards saw one of his most important things to try and establish the way in which natural sciences could be useful for doing Christian theology. And therefore, Torrens argues that there is a real dialogue to be had between theology and natural science that is not opportunistic or arbitrary. Very important point. But actually is grounded in the way things are. And for Torrens, the doctrine of creation mandates this kind of approach. And Torrens argues that the doctrine of creation affirms a unitary vision of reality which means that there is something that theology can learn from the way in which the natural sciences operate. Obviously, Torrance has his own distinctives, and then Wedge are mighty commending his specific approach by Anne Sale. This has real potential. And certainly, for Torrance, we're looking at theology rather than religion, and we're looking at our direct engagement in theology and natural sciences. And actually, a very old model can be useful. The idea of Jan Schiller, the notion as a handmaid of theology. That's an idea I'm sure many of you basically have come across in some form before, that theology uses helpmates, dialogue partners, to stimulate its thinking, to kind of give it additional conceptualities, which may be useful in articulation of what theology is trying to do. As advantages and dangers are well known, the advantages are it gives you access to new ways of thinking, to additional frameworks, which can be very, very helpful. The drawback is if using Platonism as a handmaid, your theology may simply be baptized Platonism. The handmaid becomes the mistress. So there is an issue there, but nevertheless, it seems worthwhile. And again, if we look at the past, for example, you can see in the early Christian period, Platonism being extremely helpful. In the Middle Ages, Aristotelianism, more recently, Hegelianism, or perhaps existentialism. But the key question is there anything that can be learned by theologians from the natural sciences? And Torrance would certainly say that there is. And therefore, I want to suggest again, this is a very important agenda that this group of distinguished people could take forward. And in my own case, I'm trying to do this very briefly in a series of three volumes, which basically just try to say, look, in every case, for example, the way in which natural science adopts a realistic perspective parallels our theology, the way in which the scientific engagement with the real world leads to theoretical reflection parallels our theology. There are some very interesting things here that we could follow through. And just to mention one of these, some of you have heard of Roy Baskar. If not, he was interesting and very significant. You want to think about the philosophy of emergence. So Baskar develops the idea of the stratification of reality. Very simple idea. Basically, we shouldn't talk about different perspectives of nature, but rather think of nature as a multi-level reality consisting of various strata, each of which has its own distinctive mode of engagement. And therefore, the methods you might use in physics cannot be applied quite so easily in biology, still less in sociology, but there is clearly some connection between them. And again, just trying to recognize that reality is complex and can be broken down into different realities. And again, just a simple example to make this point. Those of you who are interested in epidemiology will know about the ICIDH2 model of illness. They're always used now in terms of initial, with the original acronym, the International Classification of Impairments, Disabilities, and Handicaps, includes two words that we no longer want to use. Therefore, simply, disability and handicap, these are no longer acceptable. Therefore, the initials that we use, but basically, think of this. What is an illness? What is an illness? As you think about it, you can see it has various elements, various strata. One of them is clear, the pathology. There's something wrong. You might have a brain tumor. But there's more to it than that. This leads to impairment. For example, it means you do not think quite as effectively as you might in the past, which leads to a change in your activity. You can no longer do certain things which were dependent on that function that's been impaired by that pathology. And that has implications at the sociological level, in that there are now certain social roles you cannot play because of this impairment to your activity that results from this pathology. And the point is that illness is all of these things. It's a very simple one. And I hope I cast some light on that point to some of the others.
So the point simply is that it reminds us that with a complex reality, there are different ways in which we can interact with things. All I would say is that there are some very interesting possibilities there. Moving on. We recently celebrated the 200th anniversary of William Paley's death. Natural theology, in many ways, seems an ideal meeting point, an ideal point of engagement for the natural sciences and Christian theology. And as classically defined, natural theology is something like this. William Olson's definition: the enterprise is supporting of providing support for religious beliefs by starting from premises that neither are nor presuppose any religious beliefs. Now, this is a definition. I would suggest it might not be a helpful definition, but let's move on. What I want to make is actually it's having a bad time of mind. We've got Richard Swinburne, who is very sympathetic, wrote this article recently where I think you can see clearly is picking up that an awful lot of criticism of natural theology around. And it's much worse in the German speaking world. This is Christopher Koch's very famous study of the fate of natural theology in German Protestantism. And Koch, in an astonishing conclusion, talks about in not bending like that, anything that is zero, that human being will be. The need to de-hereticize natural theology. In other words, he's saying things have got so bad that for many theologians to talk about natural theology is instinctive to head down a heretical road. So clearly, there is something that needs to be reflected on. And the problem is, there are so many problems. Now, I mean, I must say there might be an upside as well, but let's look at the downside of which. One is that natural theology is seen as being evidence deficient, and whilst Richard Dawkins and I do disagree on many things, I think one of the relatively few things we agree on is that William Paley's approach actually is scuppered by Darwin. And I think that there's a clear issue with that. Of course, that does not prevent us from reformulating Paley's approach, or indeed developing alternatives that are more viable. Karl Barth's critique of natural theology, that I hinted at a minute ago, really is saying that if God has revealed himself, what is the point in doing natural theology? Why try to re-establish what we already know? It's just reinventing the wheel, or even worse, it's trying to establish God's identity and nature using techniques we've invented rather than one that God has given to us. Again, there's an issue. John Henry Newman, critiquing William Paley, argued that Paley's approach was of an intellectual part with doing a crossword puzzle. In effect, he's saying, look, here's the best way of making sense of something, but where is there any sense of glory or wonder or majesty in this engagement? It's simply some sort of rational sense-making which fails to preserve the grandeur. Or again, Hugh Miller, president of the Scottish Theological Society in the early 19th century, saying, well, look, William Paley says that the world is like a machine, but machines can be very ugly. Where is the place for beauty in Paley's account of things? Now, obviously, these are significant criticisms, but I think they can be met. And just to explore with you some possibilities, I believe that natural theology is worth thinking about and might actually be a very important point of interaction between scientists and theologians. Number one, we stop talking about natural theology as proving God's existence. And again, as I was suggesting a few moments ago, it's really about resonance, not proof of resonance. For example, John Henry Newman's quote, I believe in design because I believe in God. Not in God, because I see design. Well, what you're saying is, look, starting from my belief in God, I am led to believe this world is designed, and I see that, and it reinforces, it resonates my faith in God. But it doesn't seem to be established the other way around.
who gave a very good article in the John Tolkien book, basically looking at, I think it's six areas in which theology, Christology, Christian Trinitarian theology offers a better explanation of the world, human consciousness, and various things than any of the writers. Not proof, but certainly a very strong resonance between what we believe and what we see. So again, that certainly is something worth thinking about. And again, Thomas Torrance, based here in Edinburgh, would argue that natural theology is not trying to prove God's existence by looking around you, much more looking at the world from the standpoint of the Christian faith. In other words, Torrance argues an approach to nature that arises from within the Christian tradition, which allows us to see nature as God's creation. And again, just reminding us that we always see something as something. Albert Camus's famous point that scientific observation is always clearly laid. In other words, we look at something and see it as something. We look at the world, we see it as God's creation. And once we see it like that, and what we observe reinforces and resonates, so it leads us on to believe this more deeply. And again, Torrance is an important point of that. And theology, natural theology, surely is about more than just trying to make sense of things. Certainly the rise of the Enlightenment made a very significant appeal to the rationality of things. And I don't want to lose sight of that. Things make sense, and that's important. But we need to go beyond simply making sense of things. Because otherwise, we lose sight of the beauty of nature, the beauty of God, and those are extremely important things to bear in mind. So I suggest there's a need to recover a deeper vision of natural theology as a quest for truth, beauty, and goodness. And again, if you make a link now with the rise of scientific atheism, and certainly Richard Dawkins argues, particularly his book, Unweaving the Rainbow, that in some way believing in God leads to an aesthetically attenuated engagement with the reality. Here's a quote. The universe is genuinely mysterious, grand, beautiful, awe-inspiring, but the kind of views of the universe which religious people have traditionally embraced have been puny, pathetic, and meaningless in comparison to the way the universe acts. It's not like a sort of schoolboy issue. The universe presented by organized religions is a pokey little medieval universe and extremely limited. Now, it's interesting, but again, I think it's unsustainable, but it's a very influential, unsustainable judgment, and that we need to know what to say in response. Or what we might do is just look at medieval view of the universe there. And let's agree it's wrong, but actually, it's not that pathetic, is it? Anyway, that's a side point. I think one of the key questions that you've got to think about is this. In what way does your Christian faith lead you to understand and appreciate nature better than someone who's not believing that? In other words, I'm asking you to think about the outcome of faith. What difference does your faith make to the way you view and inhabit the world? Now, obviously, that involves ecologically. What about aesthetically? I would suggest that this is well worth thinking about. And many of you I know have thought about this, but just to stimulate further thinking, I would suggest there are three levels in which a Christian approach to nature helps us appreciate what we see. One is that there is an immediate sense of wonder at the beauty of nature. And Dawkins argues, if you believe in God, you do not have that sense of awe wonder as a non-Christian one. He offers no empirical evidence, and the empirical evidence I have seen does not support his judgment. Those who are interested, there's a very interesting article by Kelsey and Hyde looking at the way people experience awe in looking at the natural world. And they reflect on the theology of this. It's very interesting. That's worth looking at. So we, like anybody else, will see a rainbow, and our heart will skip a beat. You know, that is the natural response. And interestingly, that's perceptual. Even before we become to think about what it is, it just happens. Then secondly, of course, and there is a sense of wonder at the mathematical or theoretical representation of reality that arises from. Not that nature itself can be beautiful, it's the mathematics of it can be exceptionally elegant. And in fact, the more elegant the representation, probably, the more likely it is that it's right. Why should believing in God make that not be the case? Dawkins asserts it is so. But there is no evidence for it. And again, we might think of an alternative. James McAllister's very interesting book there makes some very important points. But let's look at a very obvious example, which is James Clerk Maxwell's famous publication of 1865. And basically, Maxwell's approach, as many people know, was driven by his theology. There is a God who is living. There is only one reality, therefore I would expect the mind of God to be expressed in a certain way that we can mathematically represent, and therefore I would expect there to be a unity across nature, which I can represent mathematically. And in the case of the whole question of the relationship between electricity and magnetism, I mean basically, these are later versions of the equation, but basically his point was some very elegant thinking results. But third, and this is why I think there's a real difference that can be made. If you're a Christian, you will look at the world and you will say that in some sense this is a wonderful reflection of a yet more wonderful creator. God's beauty is tempered, I have no doubt, by the natural world. But it's reflected in some way. And therefore, the silence, the direct engagement with nature is, in one sense, a direct engagement with something that God has made. Point Calvin made many, many times. Calvin would express envy of the physiologist and the astronomer who got to know more about the works of God than he did. And you might think of Psalm 19, verse 1. Again, it's important because it's not enough to say my faith makes sense. The question is, does your faith make a difference to the way in which you see the world and the way in which you engage with it? I think the answer is yes. Sometimes we need to articulate this more aggressively and coherently than we do in the past. For those who are interested, we're having a big conference in Oxford on this next year, and we have some student scholarships there. If anyone's interested, those of you watching the news, let me hasten to assure you, the Museum of Natural History is a model of Oxford's relatively few hills. Therefore, we don't need to worry about the floods, the two-step station in the lower parts of Oxford. Finally, what on earth are we going to do to ensure there is a rising generation that's interested in the relation of science and faith? Up to this point, I've tried to throw some answers at you. On this one, I'm not sure what the answers are, but I'm certainly sure it needs to be done. I'm going to leave that question on the screen, and what copy of the presentation you can get it. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Invisible things involved in making everything invisible things of the world.
That's a classic explanatory theology. Let me explain it like this. This audience is visible. If I were blind, I could not see you. You are there, and you are visible, but I would not be able to see you. And in many ways, part of Paul's whole understanding of the dilemma of human situations is that in some way we've been blinded by the spirit of this age. Therefore, we need in some way to have our eyes open. And in many ways, natural theology is about opening our eyes so we can see things as they actually are. It's been a very significant theme right throughout the history of natural theology. For example, John Ruskin, a very famous British art historian and cultural figure in the 19th century, he says that the key to science and religion and art is seeing things as they really are. And what he's really mean, actually, is a very, very powerful statement. And he's saying is that seeing is something we need to reflect on. It's not something that always comes naturally. We have to practice, or we may need divine assistance. But certainly, I would agree with you entirely that these things may be visible, but nevertheless, we very often don't see them because we are blind. But I can take it a stage further. If you're like me, you can enjoy reading detective novels, particularly the less honest version of detective novels written by Agatha Christie. The clues are all visible, but you don't notice them. You know, that's one of the questions. You can see but not see. And again, you think of Mark chapter 4, Jesus talking about the parables of the kingdom. You know, there are about things like seed being sown, seed growing in secret, but the mystery of the kingdom is only made known to some. Others see but don't see. In other words, they see something, but it's not the right thing that they see. And that is the real problem. It's not just about seeing things, it's seeing things in a certain way, which is the right way. I mean, to give you an example, again, E.O. Wilson, in his intellectual autobiographical reflections, would very often say that his particular way of thinking about the world was a reflection of, was a result of looking at nature. And he looked at nature and he saw it in that way, which led him in that direction. I look at nature, I see it in a very different way. And indeed, by the time I talk about my own discovery of Christianity, which actually made a very big impact here. So things may be visible, but either we don't see because we're blind, or we miss the true meaning. We see what is there, but we don't behold it, we don't interpret it correctly. And that seems to be a very important point for developing the natural theology as not just seeing, but noticing, but appreciating the full significance of something that can be seen, but isn't appreciated for what it really is. Thank you.
I'll take one over there, and then come back to one down here. We have two microphones, one on either side. So one over there, Priscilla.
My question is about the multiverse hypothesis. Do you know of any experimental evidence for it? And can one even conceive of how any experimental evidence might be obtained?
Well, I'm very happy to answer both those questions. But when I say no to each of them, that is a statement of my knowledge. It's not a statement of the situation. So with that caveat, I cannot really think of any experimental evidence that makes me think that is the best explanation. Nor can I really think on the basis of what I currently understand in the present state of things of something that actually takes us in that direction. I can understand entirely why some, reflecting on what they do observe, suggest this is a plausible way of looking at things. But it's plausible, but it's not something that really evidence force supports. So that's how I would understand that. So I want to stress that I speak as an amateur in that matter, and therefore I want to be very cautious in my judgment. Again, there have been a lot of books recently written on this. You might want to look at that interesting collection of essays edited by Carr, not all by Carr, which actually I think really lay out what the options are.
And I think there are reasons we've come to what the reasons for each are. My feeling is that the best explanation simply is the universe we're in is the universe that is, and that's it. But of course, that is not the universe we're separate. And for me, I find it personally, for me, if I've understood the multiverse hypothesis correctly, you know, we're put in a slightly difficult position, having to say, well, look, we observe things, we make sense of things, and this is simply true of our locality. Somewhere else, they may be things very different. And so it really does, think of local natural science, rather than something which is saying that we believe we are uncovering in the term universal anthropism. That is my personal concern about that. Thank you.
Yes, Alistair, may I use such an analogy, saying that natural theology is like a witness on the witness stand. We are not judge, God is judge, we are not a prosecutor, Dawkins may be a prosecutor, and we are not defense attorney, theologians may be the defense attorney, but we are witness. We should, let's say, witness for defense, and we should enthusiastically and with all conviction and present all the evidence we have, so that whoever in the jury box will listen to our witness. What's your opinion?
Well, I personally think you're right. I would simply agree with everything you said. I would, though, just build a little bit more on it. I want to say, actually, very often in this debate, there is not a meeting of minds at all. I mean, I think one of the things I have noticed is, you know, when I'm asked a question by an atheist, I would say, well, I can make the following responses, and I'll give what I think is a reasonable response, and say, well, that's exactly what I expected you to say. And because I was being predictable, I had to be wrong. I mean, it was even a peculiar expert, but in English language, that both being predictable and unpredictable are bad things. There is a real issue here about how one does engage in public discussion about this. I mean, very often, people have very, very strong views which they're locked into, and they are not going to budge. And very often, the issue is simply trying to bludgeon you into their position. I think that there are two things I want to say. Number one is this. Every one of you who is a natural scientist and is a Christian, simply because you are both of those things, is an extremely important corrective to what Richard Dawkins is saying. And before you even sort of talk about anything, the fact that you are both of those things is actually medicine. Because many of my atheist science friends who are orthodox would say, well, it's obvious Dawkins is wrong because I know so and so, and he's perfectly normal, and he believes in God, he's a good scientist. So that's it, end of discussion. And it's not the most rational of arguments. But you can see it makes sense to it. It's kind of argument that gets home at a more than rational level. It's a very simple thing. And secondly, people very often ask me why in my life and I wrote that little book in response to Dawkins. And I'll have to simply look. If we don't say something, people will assume that there is nothing to be said. And therefore, what I want to say to you is you may feel that your response is not good as it could be, but by simply making a response, actually, you're beginning to challenge this very characteristic atheist stereotype, which is that Christians have got no defense of their faith. It's obviously wrong, so why don't they just go away and get fired? Let me tell you something just intriguing over there. My publisher's rep is at a Christian bookseller's conference, and he showed them this book about Dawkins. Oh, this is very interesting. One bookseller said, wonderful, you look by Alistair. This is going to sell. Who is this man Dawkins?
We're in the middle there, and then we'll try to go back out.
tonight about natural theology. What is your short take on the whole idea of intelligent design? Francis Collins, for example, was very suspicious of intelligent design. In fact, I heard him speak recently where he warmly and firmly was saying to evangelical Christians that we should give up our affection for intelligent design because it was a form of perhaps a God to dance, and he was distrustful of the message. What's your take on that?
Yes, I know what Francis Collins means. I think there are two things I want to say here. One is, I think intelligent design does make some good points. It does offer a helpful critique of what I would describe as greedy reductionism. I want to stress that if you're a scientist, then one of you are trying to reduce things to simple general principles. But I think that children like Richard Dawkins or indeed Daniel Dennett really are trying to take things much further down than they really need to be. I think that's particular. I think they are right to use the right gun to endorse it. I think my concern is that what they're offering in its place, I think it does run the risk of the golf of the natural approach. Let me explain. Michael Beebe's book, Biology by Fox, which I read very interestingly enough. I mean, things have moved on even since that book was published. And the real danger is this, that very often people put their faith in God, sustain their faith in God, saying, well, science can explain that, so I'm safe. And then I'm afraid at some point in the future, that is explained. And their faith collapses. And that's my concern. It's deeper than what Francis Collins said. What I'm worried about is people, in effect, taking something and making foundational their faith, when actually it shouldn't be. That's what I'm really worried about. I understand where they're coming from, but I think potentially it can be unprofitable. So I'm cautious, guarded. One to say that they're making a good critique, but unhappy about the deeper realities they presuppose lie on.
Because worries that you use battles. And actually historically it did by doing so.
And that's my worry, really. Actually, you might say a replay of the, what I would describe as the fundamentalist disaster of the 1920s and early 1930s, where they simply withdrew. And as a result, there was in some parts no force for Christian groups to get there. It all circled the wagons. And that is why I think I would like to say that there is a real need, both for Christians who are scientists, to be actively involved in their fields, but also to talk about it. But there, I think it's very important that there is a presence in that field, that you are salt and light in that culture. And my concern really is that, for example, some have encouraged those who are scientists, who are concerned with evangelicals, to in some way express that by withdrawing from scientific mainstream. Well, to me, that is simply about the evacuation of a Christian presence where it is desperately needed. So I think there's some very important sense that needs to be had, even though I suspect some would be unused to what I'm saying. But I think there's a real need for Christian presence in these fields. And my concern is that younger and perhaps more impressionable people are kind of disengaged, and we really need to encourage them to be there. And that's what this conference can do, provide a nurturing framework for encouraging up-and-coming scientists to be heavily committed to their fields, but at the same time to be reflective practitioners from the standpoint of them.
This is a semi-serious question. You mentioned towards the end about the advantages and what you've got from elegant mathematics. How do you distinguish between elegant mathematics and non-elegant mathematics?
Well, one obvious answer might be the amount of paper. And they're symmetrical, and we think, may not be my case, but certainly looks very encouraging. I look at some older attempts, and we've done it with those, for example, the Ptolemaic system. The Ptolemaic system began as a nice, simple idea, mathematically very straightforward, and then you had to add epicycle after epicycle after epicycle, and what was originally very elegant, very cumbersome, and eventually just so clumsy, people walked away from it. They felt it is so clumsy, so it's coming to that feeling that nature's not like that. Now, that's one of the things, one of the big debates about in popular science, whether elegance is a guide to truth. It's actually more intuitive that you steal something like this. And actually, it's so often in science that you keep reinforcing it, but certainly, elegance, as you will know, is a very subjective judgment. I don't think it's in the book, but I think it's been a long time talking about what's called the epistemic virtue of elegance. And actually, he does make a fairly good stab at trying to define what elegance is. And maybe that would be the place to direct you on to further questions. Thank you.
It's good to be done here on Edinburgh. I think that I should like to ask a question about geology. When we look at contingency and fine-tuning, you see on the one hand the fine-tuning across political policies, and on the other hand we see the sophistication of the life as it occurs in the case of this planet. Now, with people's realms, we have far more than a billion years of Earth history. When we look at Earth history, we see at least I would see very, very many random events. We see continental drift, but we see also major catastrophes. We see massive volcanic eruptions, even meteoric impacts. So it seems, on the one hand, that God has placed us in a planet that is terribly unsafe, and yet, on the other hand, it seems that these kind of processes seem to be driving evolution. I think that Simon Conley Morris has thought that the meteorite impact that killed the dinosaurs apparently speak about that evolution by 30 million years or so. Can you give me a theological perspective?
Well, the answer is I probably could, but it might not be all like that. I think there are a number of very big questions that emerge from a standard of how we do this. I suspect that Ben Alexander touches some of these. We also look at the hard questions that emerge in our modern. So for me, one of the hardest questions, and put very, very crudely, is why so long and why so much waste to bring us to this point? And that's a very difficult question to answer, I have to say, because A, we don't understand the process. And B, we don't know what the alternatives are. And if I make a judgment about the morality of the process, then if there's only one way, then we can't really make a judgment. If there are several possible ways, and one is clearly better than others, but one of the others was chosen, then clearly that does raise even more questions. And I guess the real difficulty we have here is to deal with this classic question of singularity. In other words, this is the way it happens. We don't know how or whether it could happen in another way. So actually trying to deal with the moral questions that emerge from this really is very, very difficult. That's one of the reasons why I find this a very, very difficult question to deal with properly, simply because for me, if I put it very, very simply, Darwinism raises the question that Christian theologians have wrestled with for a long time. Why is there evil in this world? But the Darwinian paradigm accentuates that. It's saying, look, actually, it's much worse than we thought. How can we overcome that? And that's what Christian theologians have tried very, very hard to do with various kinds of stuff. John Paul has given quite a good one, I think, draw that to Darwin. I can try and give a different approach based on the idea of incarnation. But actually, I have to say that I don't in the end find these terribly persuasive because of the kind of wasteful. So that's a very honest answer to that question. And as I say, Ben is talking about, I imagine someone needs tomorrow, and I expect that what he has to say on that might actually be very illuminating. So that would be something to look forward to tomorrow. No pressure, Ben. Let's go for it. Thank you.
You mentioned in passing that you had once been an atheist yourself. Now, you mentioned that it has been a rather long conversion process, but what were the first steps, the first two or three increments in breaking you loose from the atheistic tradition?
Thank you, Jeff. I used to be an atheist, and I grew up in Bourne, and I was studying the sciences, and Northern Ireland back in the late 60s is when I was thinking about these things, was characterized by its religious intolerance. And this seemed obvious to me. No religion, no violence. And of course, I was studying science, and it seemed obvious to me. Science explains everything. There's no need for God, and sure, for me, older, I don't need God. They don't need science. And it's a very simple world. In fact, I often use a book, and I feel that each says, I'm just saying. I would like to say that it was because I read a very good Christian book. That's actually what it was because I started studying the philosophy of science. I began to realize actually science was a lot more interesting, a lot more complicated than the sort of simplistic way of thinking about it I had developed. And what I began to realize that actually more complex, I began to realize there's an awful lot of conceptual space for the transcendent, for God. I began to realize, actually, I need to think about this again. There are a lot of chemistry. And it was during that time when really I began to be challenged with my atheism. It was actually not as inventive or robust as I had thought. I began to realize, actually, Christianity in all lot sense of life, including my science. So I did not give up my science for being a Christian. I found a way to bring these things together. And that really gave me a very deep sense of intellectual satisfaction. My conversion was intellectual. My discovery of the emotive and the aesthetic aspects of faith came later. For me, the big discovery was simply, this makes a whole lot of sense. And then I began to fill in the gaps later. But for me, that was really the big thing. In terms of my continuing Christian pilgrimage, I mean, that's still very much a big theme for me. This makes sense. this makes sense of other things. And that to me is a very, a serious book, but much more elegant than this form is, but that excellent meaning is very, very important.
If somebody joined you in an Oxford faction, so likely you have got the vision, makes a lot of sense to me. What would be the main points that you'd make about, you know, the deficiencies of that particular book?
Well, I have had this conversation. Let me just illustrate the kind of book I've got. I'm so glad you read it, it's very interesting. Why did it say the wound was on then? I think there was a man for that. And so, it's flawed. And be depressed. You know, and as you're being depressed, for example, I just think, well, I think trying to be your best friend, most of these involved are people, and man, and gentlemen. And you just really get a piece of it. And I think that really, what I've noticed is that very often the point that people say against their actors can't be right is when they're forced to say that people who they know and respect are deeply genuine for them. It's basically all for me. And then the beginning to be open to these things. I think the real difficulty with Dawkins' book is that it has a certain rhetorical image where the rhetoric very often runs way ahead of the argument that it is. And actually, my own time is that Dawkins' book really is that it can be a short image. It doesn't, I mean, Christians read it and say this. This is nice and bizarre. I've lost it really to say this man that has the worst of which some men have come from. But atheists like it. And I think really it's almost kind of almost like a book is almost like a kind of C.S. Lewis for novels. Having said that, I think he lacks the lightness of touch. He did violence to nobody, but he had violence done to him. That's an extremely important point, which actually, Dalton and I have talked about that, and actually I think he's receptive to this point. Actually, for Christianity, the ethical norm is Jesus. That is the key thing. And you can see that point. And again, it's an extremely important point to make. Dawkins' book was published in October 2006 in North America, and in that same month, there was this dreadful incident at the Amish schoolhouse in Pennsylvania, where 10 Amish schoolgirls were shot and fired and died by some crazed, psychotic gunman. What was interesting is that the Amish, and by the way, Dawkins is very, very rude about it, the Amish said, look, what would Jesus have done? And so there will be no retribution. We are just going to offer forgiveness. Now you see, that was transformative of the government's widower and family, but also had a huge impact on American popular opinion. Because we just said, look, here is a way of engaging with this issue. So I think that's how one might want to begin to deal with this. This happens then, but Christ is the moral filter through which we read the Old Testament, the theological filter, which says, this is how we interpret this, and this is how we behave. Now, obviously, I'd say a lot more than that. That's the beginning of an answer to a question which I think is a very appropriate question, actually. It's a very difficult question. Thank you.
This is a very simple question. Oxford's not such a big university, and Oxford is not such a big town. Do you ever run into Richard Dawkins? And if you do, what kind of greeting do y'all have for him?
Do I ever run into Richard Dawkins? I nearly ran over Richard. He was on a bicycle, and I was in my car, and he crossed the road, Barbara walked through the morning. I often wonder if the press is And the answer is, we don't really talk all that much, but certainly one of the reasons for Oxford and Cambridge is that there is a more bearing to student faith in general. I think it's extremely important that whatever your own kind of university is, if there's a bit going on there, you get involved. That would be great for me. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Questions about drink, I'm sure. But there are plenty of opportunities to continue this discussion. It's an effort, I would see questions for us to discuss as well. So lots of conversations going on for the rest of the evening with us. So we thank you immensely for stimulating us, for engaging our minds, and giving us a lot to think about. A very good presentation. We're achieving, and we thank you very much. Thank you.